Wait a minute, what am I doing? Two men in a what? Two friends from film school, one who graduated, one who did, and they decided to make a podcast. Okay, this has never been done before, right? Okay. This is Matthew and Harrison's Two Men in a Movie. It's not what it sounds like.
You know, I'd bring her to the left, through the power of sad boy dick. But no, it's her at the same time as also feuding with Connie Schultz, wife of Sherrod Brown and Pulitzer winning journalist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because she called the police on me. I had an interesting college career.
We don't actually know that. That is
she
Matthew's
100%
theory.
Called the police on me.
That is Matthew's
This
theory.
Is libel. Two men in a movie will take legal responsibility for that statement.
This is the official stance of Two Men in a Movie podcast. I'm saying it now.
This
the
is
official,
Matthew's theory.
We bring it up before we hit record every time. We talk about how this is the true fact we live in. She called the police on me because I said I was going to fist fight an art professor because they wouldn't invite Francis Bacon to their dinner party.
Wow.
She hated me, dude. I had
Well, yeah, you were an asshole in class. You were an absolute pain in the ass, purposefully and knowingly.
Name one time I was an asshole
I don't
in class.
You can call the cops on an annoying student.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I don't know that she called the cops. That is literally just the story he tells all the time.
Like, okay.
At no point has she said anything. Not that she would, but like, this is the Connie Schultz thing is one-sided. It was two-sided for all of, like, 6 weeks, but it is one-sided now. She has moved on in life.
Probably.
To torment other people, that horrid bitch. Name one time I was bad in that class.
When she had us write, like, a page and a half about, like, what our personal ethics system is, and you wrote a page and a half about how your personal ethics is not having to explain your personal ethics?
That's my belief.
Listen.
I'm sorry for engaging truthfully. I could have lied.
Funny. You weren't engaging truthfully. You were being an asshole.
I remember this. It was, I labeled how every single question on the thing she handed us was against my personal ethics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was the one where you told her that you think, that you believe in Eat the Rich and that she was a part of it. And like,
yeah.
I don't know what
See,
they
you,
do.
You
like,
all always be telling me, be truthful, stop lying so much. But when I'm honest, I get persecuted, I get the cops called on me.
First off,
I thought you were all anti-respectability politics, Harrison, but the moment somebody actually says something to someone's face, all of a sudden.
No, I'm pro-anti-respectability politics. I just think there's a different, when it's like she's asking a normal-ass question and you're being purposefully disruptive because you think it's funny. I'm fine with
I don't think eating the rich is funny. I think it's the moral obligation of every good-hearted American citizen.
Okay.
To be fair, I know nothing about this woman. What does she, like, believe?
That her husband tells two funny stories and needs to shut up. He kept trying to tell stories, and she'd be like, talk about the class. I don't know. She's like a DNC hardliner, I think.
Oh, okay. Sure.
I liked her class. I was an easy to get along with student, so, like, I had no problems with her.
You big vote blue no matter who.
I was a trial, all right? And it's not
Also didn't show up, like, after 3 weeks into the class.
That was a lot of classes.
It was twice a week.
I stopped showing up to my psychology class after week two. I stopped showing up to 7 ideas that shook the world or whatever after week one.
I took that online, so, like, I didn't.
There's a lot of classes.
That class
I just,
was utter bullshit.
Psychology, I got, like, an A+ in because the tests were easy. I just show up for the tests.
Yeah, those psych tests were.
But, I was a trial, all right? And it's not my fault that they failed it, all right? Sometimes God puts things in your way to test you, and they were found wanting.
Okay.
I'm a tool of divine academic testing.
No, you're a narcissistic sociopath who thinks he's funnier than he is.
God gives his most annoying battles to his most bewildered teachers.
Yeah. Welcome to the Two Men in a Movie podcast, where each week one man shows another man a movie he can't believe he hasn't seen. As always, I'm your Connie Schultz fighting champion of ethical journalism, host, Matthew Olenchek, joined as always by my vote blue no matter who co-host, Harrison Poole. How are you, babe?
I'm fine. I'm going to urgent care tomorrow because I think I have another ear infection, so I'm gonna get that checked out. We have a guest today.
We have the foremost, I've been told, I'm checking my notes here, the foremost expert on Five Nights at Freddy lore.
Yeah. Oh, wait, I have great news for you guys. There are only 120 days until Five Nights at Freddy's 2 releases.
Did you already update the group chat?
I am updating it as we speak.
It's my doomsday clock. And it doesn't. I could be out of the group chat. I still have to show up. You've trapped me like a fae.
It's my brother. Yeah, it's my brother, Ethan.
Hey, what's up? It's me.
Came out of the womb side by side, holding hands.
No, we came out like 4.5 years apart.
Holding hands.
Nope.
Like, mom, it's important. This is what brothers do.
Yeah.
God, I'm an only child. I assume that's how it works with siblings.
I mean, for us, it was something. We didn't really, like, we loved each other, and we, like, hung out because of proximity, but we didn't really, like, choose to be friends and for, like, 19 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harrison was inseparable.
Yeah, drunk all the time, just watching School of Rock.
I have seen School of Rock more than I probably would have chosen to on my own.
Yeah, yeah. That's,
you always could have left the room.
That's true. I'm not the victim here. It's a good movie. I don't love it as much as you do, but I will stand behind you on that one.
So our guest picked the movie this week. Our guest always picks the movie. But yeah.
We have such an exciting movie this week. We have David Lowery's The Green Knight.
I think it's my favorite A24 film. It's been on my list to show you until we had the guest.
It's up there. I don't know if it's my favorite. I mean, the basic answer for me is Everything Everywhere All at Once. Tusk is also up there, which I know you actively disliked.
Yeah, I don't think it's a bad movie. It just...
Yeah. Swiss Army Man is up there, but I think Green Knight edges out Swiss Army Man.
Because it's got What's-Her-Name in it. She's in Man from U.N.C.L.E. too.
Alicia Vikander?
Yeah, it's got her. It's got the most amount of splooge I've ever seen on a cinematic release.
Until The Lighthouse?
See, The Lighthouse has a lot of splooge, but it's so abstract. It's more like rain. It's like the tears of the lighthouse itself. This, like, you get like a close-up of the splooge. It is like... Like, the splooge is a hazard in The Lighthouse. He's like, oh, God, I have to avoid the splooge. Like, in The Green Knight, they do, like, a close-up on it. They're like, look at it. Look at the splooge.
Well, it's kind of a hazard in The Green Knight, like, emotionally. She tells him off immediately after because he wasn't a true
Seems
knight.
Seems like a great time. That's the ideal hand job situation, in my opinion. They jerk you off. Okay. They say, shame on you.
Okay.
I'm going to keep talking about the splooge until he moves forward.
Yeah, why? It's
It was just, so, I remember watching it in the theater, and I was like, oh, that's a close-up on it, all right? I wasn't expecting the close-up.
This is my favorite movie of all time, probably time to look back. There is a close-up of Cum in it, that is true, fair enough. But, I mean, it's easily my favorite A24 movie of all time.
Hell yeah. What exactly makes this your favorite movie, Ethan?
Well, I saw it in the theaters. It was one of the first movies I'd seen after COVID, and I just had such a crazy theater experience with it. I walked out a changed man. It fixed me. I became normal. It's incredible.
How did it fix you?
You know, I left a person capable of change, and I probably entered a person incapable of it. I don't know if that's true, but it was a great movie. I saw it at a very impactful time in my life, and it and look back are probably the best movies I've ever seen, like, to me, for that reason. I really do feel like it changed me. I think about it all the time. And this is only the second time I've ever watched it.
You talk about it. This is only the second time you've ever watched this?
Yep.
You talk about this movie so much.
You don't need to experience the end revelation twice. You know what I mean? Like, the first time is enough.
Like, I don't talk about this movie as much, but I talk about this movie, like, frequently enough. And, like, this is my second time seeing it.
That's insane. Yeah.
It's impactful, bro. It is. That's going to be you now that you've watched it. It's all you're going to think about.
It will be a thing that comes up in conversation casually. I don't know if it will be every third conversation. I'm cat out of the bag. I loved this movie. you guys love it more than me. I loved this movie. Like, I had a couple minor things that are entirely personal that I am certain on rewatches will even themselves out. I loved this movie. This movie did what Lord of the Rings and Dune failed to do for me, which is it has epic scope and like epic scale storytelling. It actually feels big for a tenth of the budget. And it feels important without insisting it's important. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I don't hate Dune as much as you do.
But I don't hate, obviously, I like Dune,
this is my
lot.
Favorite movie of all time. It means a lot to me.
I think it's
very impressive, for especially as a standalone movie where like there had to be three Lord of the Rings, two Dunes or whatever. I do think it's really impressive that they did it in one movie without, like you said, like without a crazy budget.
I think it's because it does, like, I think Dune's at its best is when it's almost dreamlike. And this movie's a big, like, galosh of dream. It's like, it's a big stew of dreamlike, and they're just stewing you in it for, like, 2 hours and 15 minutes, or however long it is.
It's 2:09.
It's a surreal, it's a surreal vibe you get, where, like, it's the heightened reality of it.
It's heightened reality. It also just, like, the world feels huge and our protagonist feels small,
which is wild because I could drive across that entire world in like 2 hours
probably. Yeah,
I think that's how long it takes to get from North England to South England.
Sure, maybe
you get to see the Welsh giants.
Also, this movie has an insane budget for an A24 movie. It's $15 million. It's not an insane budget for a movie. It's actually, it's a Blumhouse, it's a slightly above average Blumhouse movie.
They do a lot,
but for A24, this is like,
okay, they
gargantuan.
Do a lot with the budget. Again, like, it does feel like this grand adventure he's on, when like realistically he did not go that far. Like, if you were to like do a map of his journey, if you could, it's not that far of a journey, but they still manage to capture that sense of like epic scale.
Well, he walked for 9 days. I don't think it's that it's that far. I think it's that he walked for a relatively long percentage of it. He lost his horse pretty quick.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be 6 days on the horse.
He does get punked pretty immediately.
Yeah. Yes.
I like how much of a shit Gawain is in this movie.
My least favorite part of the movie is the Barry Keoghan. I just find him obnoxious. I know he's playing in a very obnoxious character, but I find him, his acting style, I've only seen him in a couple things, but I find him obnoxious and annoying. And like when he's on screen, it is actively a thing that I don't want to see. With that being said, it works for this character. I just think he's hamming it up. With that being said, it works. I just think it's my least favorite part of this movie. But again,
my least favorite part of this movie was the puppet, because you texted me in the middle of watching it about it.
No, that's not my least favorite part of this movie.
The puppets are a highlight for me personally.
No, the puppets are great. The puppets are a highlight.
I loved the puppets.
Yeah. I just thought it was weird that the puppet was like six shades lighter than Dev Patel was. It's like that they casted a white puppet before they casted their actor.
Racist puppet maker.
I definitely think it isn't that. It's very clearly based it off of Dev Patel. I think you can see it in the hair and the beard. That he looked like that before this movie, so they were basing it off of him.
I think the issue is also, if you paint a puppet too dark,
it goes bad.
It starts becoming minstrel showy.
It becomes blackface.
Yeah, like that style of puppet. Yeah, yeah, like a Punch and Judy style puppet, like that era of puppet. If you make it like dark, you're getting into like the territory where we're gonna start calling him the Moor.
Yeah, I texted you just because it struck me, where I was like, why is this puppet six light shades lighter than Dev Patel? But I puppets were a highlight. I loved that scene. The first 30 minutes of this movie, I thought to myself, this is very impressive, kind of brilliant, and very unnecessary. And then the next hour and a half of the movie kind of proved itself over the time. The second hour of this movie moves way faster than the first hour of that movie does. It's really only the first half hour of that movie moves very fast. The first half hour of the adventure moves so slow, and then the last hour of the adventure feels like 15 minutes. Like, this movie is so weirdly paced, and I love it.
stream like
him. So which part didn't you like? The before he started the adventure or the first part of the adventure?
It was the Barry Keoghan part. I just think Barry Keoghan's performance in that movie, he's like hamming it up too much. But I that goes
that's
with
just
the character.
What British kids are like.
But he also
The character is also hamming it up a little too much. Like, I think it works in context.
I think it works in again, it will be a thing that I am sure, like my second or third time watching this movie, I am almost guaranteeing that I will watch this movie at least one more time this year. But like, that is a part that I can almost promise you will be smoothed over in rewatches. It just, on a first time watch, it's the only part of that movie that I wish wasn't in that movie. And it's really not even the stealing of the horse scene. It's the fact that he shows up later drunk. I think you can cut that out and the movie's the exact same. He just happens to find the horse again. With that being said, like, it's 30 seconds of a two-hour movie. I'm not going to complain.
You know what,
like,
gets enhanced on the second view?
What?
I know it's like the central theme and point of the movie.
Yeah.
How much a dumbass Gawain is. Because the first time you watch it, you're like, I don't think you need to cut the head. And the second time, you're like, kid just like punched him.
Or
give him a little kiss.
He was, he's a cocky young kid who was trying to prove himself around the other knights. Like,
he had just been like called out in public that he didn't have anything impressive going on in his life by like his uncle, the king, the most important person in the country.
But the king also followed it up with, it's a game.
I mean, there are a lot of things he could have done. Garwin is not a smart person who thinks through his decisions. Yeah. But I think he's at his core a good person, sort of.
Historically, strongest at noon.
Yeah. What?
Historically. In the literature, like, this toes into what I really like about Arthurian lore, and I wish there was more of it, is that all the Arthurian legends have, like, these characters performing, like, almost super heroic feats. And, like, Gawain would get, when the sun was high, is Gawain had, like, incredible superhuman strength and myth.
Also,
that's awesome.
If we're touching on Arthurian lore, I love that King Arthur, like, is a primary character in this story, and at no point do they really make much mention that it's King Arthur.
Yeah,
like,
no, he's even credited as just the king. He's not given a name.
But if you know the chivalric romance, that's what this is adapted from, that official, like, that collection.
I believe so.
You know that Gawain was Arthur's nephew.
Yeah, and it's the Round Table too. It's clearly, but they trust the audience.
I think it's they trust the audience, but I also think that David Lowry understands what's important to the story and what isn't important to the story. Like, all you need to know is that they are respected knights.
Also, it's like a medieval king, and like most Americans only know two English kings, I'd say. Maybe three.
They would know names from stories, but I don't think they would know historical context.
Yeah, but I'm just saying that, like, you would, like, the average audience is going to be like, there must be this king.
Obviously, I'm calling you on my phone, Ethan, so I don't have access to it to look up, but your Letterboxd review, I forget exactly what it was, but something to the extent of, like, this movie not only explores, like, what it means for a person to be great, but what it means for a person to be good.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's, I think, one of the best lines in the movie is, why greatness, why is goodness not enough, from Essel, I think her name is, or something like that.
Essel?
Yeah, Essel. I think it's like an interesting juxtaposition to throw in before the adventure, because it sort of like frames you to think about, like, what is the good choice and what does it mean for a knight to make that good choice, and what does failing at knighthood mean and vis-a-vis being a good person. And I think it's like, I mean, all that comes to a head at the dream sequence at the end, right? You see him go back, become a king, become this like great honorable person, and it like fucking sucks. His son dies, he's a shitty partner, it's terrible for everybody, that like you can't necessarily, like, I think it's like, it's sort of a trite thing, I guess, to say that, like, oh, like, you shouldn't care about being excellent. You should care about caring about people. But I think especially in, like, mythological stories like this, we usually do value more excellent greatness, like great deeds. And I think Lowry really interestingly subverts that. And I think he picked a good Arthurian story to pick to subvert it. And I think it really ties the movie together well in a way that could feel preachy, but I don't think it does.
I think it's also good because, like Arthur does great things and is good, but, like, he's one of, like, the few people in those stories who's, like, does great things, is good. Like, everyone else is kind of, like, like they fight for good and they do good things, but they're kind of shitty. Like Lancelot's a piece of shit. I think like Percival is like the best of them.
Well, Lancelot's a homewrecker, and I thought this was a pro homewrecking podcast.
It is, but like I'm talking about like from a movie's perspective.
Oh, sure, sure, sure.
Yeah, now Lancelot did nothing wrong in my opinion.
That's okay, fair opinion. Enough, fair enough.
And what's the quote from the movie, Ethan?
Why greatness? Why is goodness not enough?
Yes, to me that harkens back to one of my favorite movies, Harvey, when Elwood is like, my mother used to say, Elwood, in this life you must either be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. So for years I was smart. I recommend pleasant. It is this... I think in many ways they're saying the same thing, but like it's this is a very interesting tale, like
the only tale
sure.
of good and honor, foxes and giants.
I
hand jobs.
Sure. Anyway, I lost my train of thought, but like I think I somewhat made a point in there. Kind of. I think I made half of a point in there.
There was a point because there's a whole thing where he's like, you have to give back whatever you take. The man in the manor.
Yeah.
And I was watching this. He was watching the movie with. I leaned over. I'm like, is he gonna have to give him like a hand job or something? But I'm like, oh, it's just a kiss. All right.
And then he like casts him away.
Yeah. I was like, is he gonna have to give him a hand job because he took that from the house? That'd be wild. Also, on the second viewing, I noticed the manor's a bit anachronistic, which I thought was interesting. I can't say exactly why, but it's not entirely a period-appropriate manor. So I think that's fun.
In the original story, that man is the Green Knight in disguise. And I think he's supposed to be in the movie, too, but it's a lot less clear. But it is, like, magical. There is lots of anachronisms in it. And in the original story, he doesn't get a hand job, so he does just kiss the man. But yeah, by the rules of the game, he should have had to jack that dude off.
He should have jacked that dude off and then like be like, look at your cum, look at it.
So
the fox is his mom, right? That was my thought on the first viewing.
I think so. I think
representative.
The fox is it's either his mom or just like the avatar of magic that his mom also worships. Because his mom in this is Morgan Le Fay. She's not in the original story, but in this, like, she is. So she's a witch. And so I think it's connected to her in some way, for sure. Because there's that, like, match cut of their eyes.
Yeah, like, it's an aspect of her.
So, yeah.
It's been forever since I've read the original story. In what is the meaning? I know the what's the meaning of Alicia Vikander playing both the lady and Essel?
Essel is an original character to the movie, unless I'm mistaken. Yeah, it's also been a while since I've read it.
There's no literary thing.
But I mean, I think she represents in that scene, like having her be the lady is temptation, right? Like it's not just someone he wants to have sex with. It's the face and like mannerisms of someone he loves. Not just being tempted with lust, he's being tempted with love.
A very important
And that to achieve greatness,
too.
You have to reject both of those. And that maybe that's why it's not worth it, or at least part of the reason.
Because like in the dream at the end, he casts her away and everything goes to shit because that's what he needs to go to greatness.
See, that was my thing. Yes, I thought that too. But then in the dream, she casts her away and like his life is bad. So when he accepts... So when he accepts her as a lust object, his life is shit. And when he casts her away as a love object, his life is
the
shit.
The path of the righteous good knight.
He has
is
to
forehead
accept
kisses.
Good love.
It's forehead kisses, cute love notes, little, you know, it's not, it's all about hand jobs and ruling kingdoms. That doesn't make a good knight.
I think that the scene at the end, because when he gets actually to the Green Chapel, that's when he's choosing who he's going to be, right? Is he someone who goes through to his word, even to his death, or is he a coward? And the dream sequence is if he runs away and is a coward. And I think that's why he rejects her, that it would be difficult for the prince to marry a prostitute. And he has chosen in this most pivotal moment in his life to be a coward. And so that follows through to the rest of it. He doesn't have his love or real connection.
No, that makes sense.
Because the Chad Brave
You can
move.
Only do that if you're like a real hero.
Yeah, the Chad Brave hero moves to marry the prostitute. Someone's like, that's a prostitute, my lord. You go, I'm fucking king. I'm a brave knight. I'll do whatever the fuck I want. I don't give a shit what you think.
Didn't work that way. Like, the people around them, like lords or high knights or whatever, have a lot of power. Like, there's been no example, I think, of a real absolute monarchy where they genuinely, like, nobody else had any power. At least not on as large a scale as I think we're supposed to think Arthur had as, like, king of all Britain or whatever.
Yeah, I think this would be a unique... I think you could do in this case, because it is the Arthurian kingdom where, like, you know, the king truly is like this divinely chosen, like, being. Because, yeah, in the traditional ones, like, lords would be like, hey, you can't marry a prostitute, you have to marry for blood or whatever. But, you know, if your uncle is fucking King Arthur, like, direct King Arthur, I think you'd be like, fuck off, marry a prostitute. He's the once and future king of, like, England. He's gonna be back. I know I'm king now, yeah. He's gonna be back. And he's gonna say, you know what? It's really cool that my nephew married a prostitute, and you're going to feel really dumb.
Not even thematically. I love it thematically, and I love, like, how much it works. And your explanation of it makes a lot of sense. Thank you for clarifying. But on a pure technical level, I love that this movie does the whole, spoiler alert, but does the whole, like, it was all a dream thing and pulls it off. That is such a difficult thing to pull off.
I think
off
it's helped by that everything feels like a dream.
That I, maybe, but like I truly, I knew it was coming and I didn't see it coming.
I think Matthew's definitely right that it helps that it all feels like a dream. I think it also helps that even though none of it was literal, you learn so much about Garwin in that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Like it still feels like an emotional resolution, even if it's not a plot one, you know what I mean?
At the end of the day, you learn who the character not necessarily is, but could be at his worst.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also,
do you think he dies at the end?
Interesting. I don't, but what do you think?
I don't either, but I do know that Lowry has said publicly that the original script was very explicit that he died, that he changed that from the original story, and that in shooting and in the final cut, they had to walk that back and make it more ambiguous. And I think because in the original he doesn't die and they couldn't commit to it in this one, I interpret it like he survives.
Yeah,
like he does that little, like he touches his neck with his finger and says, off with your head. And that's the counting of like striking him back. Like that's him letting him go.
Me too. I think the dream sequence at the end was the death. Like I think that the Green Knight like forced him to see like what could have been
using his grandpa green powers.
Yes,
he's a grandpa. Can we talk about how much of a grandpa this guy is?
Like my favorite, we will.
When he's just sitting in the chair and he goes, "Nope, I'm awake. All right. Time to go."
But I think the dream sequence was the metaphorical death, and I think that because he killed him psychologically, or like I don't know, he showed him where it could have ended, and the fact that he showed bravery to the very end, I do think that he physically spared him to teach him a lesson.
Yeah, and I assume he goes back, actually marries Essel because he's a brave person now.
Yes.
And Camelot's gonna be okay. Like I think they have a person capable of protecting them now.
Yeah, I think that's what the movie was trying to say.
He's like, here Essel, has some of this hard candy the Green Knight gave me as I left. Pulled it out of his pocket. Tastes like butterscotch.
He is. I do love that he's such a grandpa. That he's like, he feels so ethereal and like ancient in a way that like is very like, there are lots of movies that pull it off, but there are, I think, more that fail at it that make like magical creatures really feel out of this world. And so I do think that like, I think his performance adds a lot to it. Obviously, like the whole movie's fucking on Patel's shoulders, but I think the Green Knight, the man, like all the other performance also helps.
Yeah, the gravitas of Keoghan,
I think, does good with what he's doing.
And it is because he's like this. He feels like such an ethereal, otherworldly being, but it also feels like he tells really good stories.
To comment on the grandpa thing, when he wakes up and the dude's like, is it Christmas? Like, he didn't quite do the dramatic genie, 10,000 years will give you such a creak in the neck, but he very much had the, like...
He doesn't do the magical genie thing. He does your grandpa's waking up after falling asleep in his chair. He's like, what is Christmas? All right, where's my ex?
Also, I have not seen Life of Pi, so maybe he does this in this movie. This is the second movie where Dev Patel has an action scene underwater where he has to hold his breath for a long-ass time.
If you have a skill.
He does. He's a great action performer. Have you guys seen Monkey Man?
I have not.
It's really good. It's his directorial debut. Like, I think he's got, like, he's not just a good actor, he's a good director. I think it shows that he, like, cares about film, which also I think helps in this, that I imagine he put his all into this performance. I think it really shows.
I was looking up reviews on this movie. They're mostly positive. They are way more mixed than I thought they would be. Like,
this might sound pretentious, but I genuinely think this is one of those movies that'll come out to mixed reception and then 25 years from now will be seen as a masterpiece.
Maybe. I love it. True. I walked away where I'm like, I mean, there are a couple scenes that I would have either been shorter or like I wasn't in love with, but overall I'm in love with this movie. Oh, and sure. Then I went online and looked, and especially amongst like the people I follow, it varied wildly.
It was a busy year. So we had Spider-Man No Way Home, No Time to Die, Quiet Place Part 2, Shang-Chi, Suicide Squad, Dune, Godzilla vs. Kong, the second Venom, Candyman, and probably what it was competing against was either F9 or The Last Duel.
Have you seen Nia DaCosta's Candyman remake?
No, I haven't seen a single Candyman.
It rules. I might add
it. I heard it's really good.
Yeah, I might add it. She has a really, really good twist on the character.
Is he made of candy in this one?
No. Mm. He's just a metaphor for something different. Anyway.
I'm going to see if it won any awards.
I don't think it would have won like an independent spirit more than an Oscar, I would think. A24 before, I mean, this would have been right after Everything Everywhere All at Once, I guess. I was like, before that movie, or right before, like before that movie, they just kind of existed in the space as opposed to like they've won, I think, 3 of the last 5 years.
What the fuck's Nomad? Nomadland?
Nomadland's really good.
Okay.
Don't know if it was best picture of that year personally. It's really good.
Hearing that list, I do kind of think this was the best shot movie of the ones you mentioned, but I also see an argument for a lot of the other ones. It was a stacked year.
Judas and the Black Messiah pulled a bunch of winnings too, and There's the Father also came out apparently.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm not seeing it for any awards. Or even nominations.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's a shame.
Yeah, that sucks. They should do, I forget the name of the YouTuber, but he does like a top 10 list like 15 years later. So like this year he will be doing the top 10 of 2010.
Oh, that's fun.
He like lets things cool. Similar. I truly think like in 2036.
Oh, Tenet came out that year too.
Green Knight is definitely going to be in the top 5.
Oh yeah. I mean, this is, yeah. It was clearly a stacked year, but I do think this really comes out on top. I think Dev Patel is going to, he's already obviously very famous. I think now that he's also directing movies, he's only going, I think he'll have like a Greta Gerwig or Jordan Peele style career where he like becomes famous for multiple things. I think this is I think history will look well on this movie.
To bring it back a little bit, just to like talk about the movie more generally, something I did not know that this movie did that annoyed me at first and then I immediately got into the groove of was when it was telling different parts of the like different chapters of the story, it would like have a little title card for the thing. Title cards in general, I don't love. I think it
I love me a title card.
I think it works very well with this because it feels like a fairy tale.
What's the other movie we saw with, it was on the podcast, I think, that had title cards?
Asteroid City has title cards.
Asteroid City, that's what I was thinking of. I love me a title card.
Asteroid City does fine. Those title cards do nothing for me. I kind of think they don't need to exist, but beside the point.
I don't want to get lost in the movie.
About the third time, I thought it was going to annoy me because they were like so close together, because the first 30 minutes essentially adapts like 4 different stories.
Yeah.
And then once the journey starts, each individual story starts to last a little longer so that like the world feels more lived. I mean, not more lived in. It feels like each story is makes it feel like parts of a whole, like a fairy tale. Like it felt like a complete story.
Totally. I think it really works to make it feel like, obviously the metaphor of the puppet show is that it's also kind of what we are watching. And yes. I think it makes it work to make it feel that way, that it's still a little put on. It's still a little as much performance as it is. We're supposed to be invested, you know?
It feels like, yes, I like the puppet show thing. It feels like you're reading the story. Like, I know this isn't, like, an exact adaptation, but, like, it visually feels like David Lowery read Chivalry. Like, he read the story. He knew what parts needed to be adapted, like, verbatim, and then what parts he could emotionally adapt.
No, I mean, I agree. I think this is a really good adaptation. Like Matthew was saying, I love a good myth movie.
We don't get enough.
I think it does a great job picking which parts of the like mythos to bring in while still making it feel lean and not like over bloated with references you need to read the fucking Lamont to Arthur to understand.
I hope we get more. I hope that's the next cycle of stories we get after the superhero cycle dies.
The Odyssey is coming out, so it's very possible.
I was thinking about that because like, the Odyssey is coming out. Like, we're still going to have superhero movies forever because that's just how movies work. You always, even though there's cycles, you still have them. But like, I think we're about to see a turn in cinema, especially both Thunderbolts and Fantastic Four, which did well critically, like, are not making their money back. And I think Doomsday is going to be a doomsday for the Marvel movie cycle because there's no way that movie's making back a tenth of its acting budget alone.
I will say it isn't making its money back, and that sucks. Related to Fantastic Four, the actor for Galactus is the actor for the Green Knight.
Yeah, you can tell with the voice.
Also, that movie was pretty good. I watched Superman earlier in the month and was blown away. Sort of automatically assumed that the MCU movie that came out right after it, I was going to hate. But it was actually okay. It turns out Pedro Pascal came out.
Yeah, no, they're doing good. Just like they're not making their money back. And I'm like, because what? How, it's usually like the marketing budget's like how much of the...
For big studio movies, the marketing is the budget making the movie. So when it says $150,000, double it in your head.
Yeah, so think about doubling Robert Downey Jr.'s pay. Like, because they're getting like everyone. They're like, we're just going to do tons of cameos. I'm like, I wouldn't be surprised if it's the biggest budget for actors of any movie of all time.
It's like how Avatar 2 needed to make $2 billion to break even.
Yeah.
Yeah, low-key... although they're resetting the universe after Secret Wars, so they seem, even with these losses, geared to keep trucking.
Yeah, I just don't know if they can. I think Doomsday is going to kill it. I think it's going to be too big of a financial failure, and then we'll have like Odysseys and Beowulfs. Let's get another Beowulf movie.
That would be awesome.
A24 Beowulf. David Lowery, if you're listening, you're not. But if you're listening, adapt Beowulf.
Let's just start doing myth movies. Like, they're pretty much superheroes, but they're a bit more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I would love that. And you could even, like, superheroes could adapt that more. They could do a Marvel Hercules movie. They could do more Thor.
Yeah.
Like, there's already that little bit seed planted in the previous big thing for that to be the next big thing.
And, like, you don't have to put, you know, it's so much, you don't have to, like, think of ideas.
Yeah, I think it really does depend on how Nolan's Odyssey does to see, like, if we're going to get more of that. It's coming out next year.
Yeah, I think so.
So there will be 5 years between. Have there been any more, like, big myth movies in between?
The Return, but not a lot of people saw it. But it's also just the end of the Odyssey. It has Ralph Fiennes in it. I think it made its money back, but it wasn't a huge budget.
Isn't
but,
Ralph like, in this one,
people are
too?
Starting to explore the space a little bit.
Isn't Ralph in this one, too?
I believe a different Ralph.
Huh.
Maybe I said the wrong name. I meant the like guy from Conclave, Voldemort, was in the...
Yeah, Ralph Fiennes.
I think he's also in The Odyssey.
Oh, he might be in The Odyssey. He's not in The Green Knight.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were talking about.
I hope it also brings people to go watch some older myth movies. Look, I'm a Robin Hood defender. The most recent Robin Hood movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a defender of it. I hope when we reach the myth cycle that gets its day in the sun.
The Russell Crowe one?
No. The most recent one with
like the edgy one, like the one that's trying to be Batman Begins.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll die in a hill defending that movie. That movie kicks ass.
I've never seen it. I've just heard of it. But maybe it is good. I really liked Disney's Robin Hood as a kid, so also maybe rewatch that.
It does a thing. It adapts it where, like, it kind of contemporizes it where, like, and I'm like, people are like, oh, they made it seem like when Robin was off at war, it was like the war and terror. And I'm like, yeah, so you fucking understand it. I'm not against that. I'm not against it making, like, anachronisms or alluding to modern day events when retelling these myths if it helps the audience understand. Because the audience isn't going to fucking understand, like, isn't going to have a great understanding of the Crusades. But if you go, it's like the war in Iraq, a failed war where the white guy died repeatedly because he was stupid as shit. That work, it sells the story.
Yeah. I mean, if we're right and it's a new set of myth movies, I'd love that. I have not seen that new Robin Hood, but maybe I should.
I think
you
are
convincing me.
I think it's really good. It's fun. I think people took it too seriously. It's a fun fucking movie. It hits all the beats a Robin movie needs to hit.
You mentioned it in the Man of Uncle episode, and so I purposefully not watched it.
Yeah, I mentioned it's a movie I think it's a lot of shit because they're like, oh, they made the Robin Hood's Merry Men like Antifa. That's stupid. I'm like, what? It's to connect you to the story. It's to create an emotional connection. So you go, oh, because like you as an American of the 21st century might have a hard time imagining being a peasant who's overtaxed.
Yeah.
You will connect with police violence. And they kind of filter things to make like a police violence veneer over it so you understand what's happening. And also it doesn't need to be. Anachronisms are okay.
Yeah, I think if you're doing it for a reason and you're telling a story purposefully, yeah.
Totally. I think, although that is something interesting about The Green Knight, like you said earlier about how there were some anachronisms, but they were still like old-timey. It's like a Victorian manner or whatever. I think it helps that movie, not that the Robin Hood movie necessarily doesn't feel timeless. I haven't seen it. But I think it does help this movie feel sort of timeless in that way. And especially because the arc is so personal and not global in that sense that like, I think you could have watched this 200 years ago if there were movies and they'd get it. And I think if there are still movies 200 years from now, you can watch it and go get it.
Yeah, and like, today's audience, a Victorian manor sells the idea better than like a period-appropriate manor would.
Yeah, for sure.
People would see it and be like, what the fuck's this? Because when they think manor, they're not thinking of a manor of that time period. They're thinking of like Victorian manor. That's where the mind goes.
I want to throw this out at you guys and see your opinion. I know you guys talk a lot about religion on this podcast. What did you guys think of the St. Winifred sequence? Like, did that do anything? Like, what do you think it means for him to encounter like a religious figure in that way?
I'm just happy that they didn't make him a Protestant.
Well, this is pre-Reformation.
I love it. I love that I can, for 2 hours and how many minutes?
9 minutes.
2 hours and 9 minutes, I can live in a world without that nasty man, Martin Luther. I mean, no, I thought it was good. I think that Arthurian lore hinges very heavily on, like, Christianity and, like, the Catholic faith. Because, like, at that time period, there wasn't even really an idea of, like, Europe or states, even. There was the idea of, like, Christendom. Like, a lot of maps from that period have Jerusalem at the center of the world.
Oh, okay.
Those maps are crazy. I've seen a lot of them. Like, I study history. I've seen a lot of them. And I will say, if I actually believed that the world had Jerusalem at the center and three equally shaped continents spreading out from it, I would believe in an intelligent creator.
Yeah.
Like, it does make sense from that worldview why they think it looks that way.
But, like, I do think that I think something would have been lost in their Arthurianness of it if they didn't have some religious scene.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, I really like that sequence. I just wanted your guys' take on it. I know you guys have very strong religious opinions. I mean, this is even pre-schism. They're not even really Catholic. They're just like Chalcedonian, I guess.
Yeah, they're just the Christian Jesus love and faith. Because like if you do a Percival story, you'd have to do the same thing even more. Because that like his whole thing's the Holy Grail as a concept, and like the Grail Knights were really big in Arthurian stuff.
I would be interested. Maybe it would be doing too much of the same like stuff for him. I would be interested to see if Lowry has a different, like a meaningfully different take on other knights. Like what he would do with Percival.
I would love to see what he does with the Fisher King.
See, I don't know if I would. I mean, I want Lowry to make any movie he wants to make ever. I don't know if I would want Lowry to just make Arthurian knights movies anymore. Although it is working with Rian Johnson and Django
so
Craig right
many.
Now, but. I would like to see like a crew, like a Rat Pack style of not necessarily.
We're the Arthur boys. We make Arthur movies.
But like not necessarily.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. Not necessarily like an Arthurian cinematic universe. Like they don't need to be connected. But like an
like
A24 like crew that's what they
like
do.
How you have the gangster movie crew who made all the great like gangster movies. Yeah.
I also, if Lowry just wants to Knives Out Arthurian tales forever, he can do that. Like I'm so happy with that. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about with this movie?
It changed my life. I also think it's really, really good. But I do think a real part of the reason why I love this movie so much is that I do think genuinely, at such an impactful time in my life, like right after COVID, I was graduating high school, it made me want to both create things and be a better person. And I think those are two good instincts to have, like, stoked and talked to by art. So hell yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's a good as place as
any. I think you should have to watch as a movie right after graduation, dude.
Green Knight is to you what Harvey is to me.
I didn't have a movie like this.
Yeah.
Right? Like I know okay. Harvey came out like before either like actually.
But it's when you watched it. Yeah.
I don't think I have a big like turning of the age movie for me personally. I'm realizing that.
But
hey, which of these movies? Help me before we go. Help me pick a movie that I'm gonna watch and say was my big high school movie.
No, okay. Oh my gosh.
Here's my options: Gravity, 12 Years a Slave, The Wolf of Wall Street, World War Z, The Great Gatsby, or Her, or Now. I guess we could also throw Now You See Me.
Wolf of Wall Street was a lot of people's big high school movie. I don't know if it's great for that necessarily, but it was a lot of people's.
It's not good for that, especially when you are an artist. The thing is, though, yeah.
See, I'm leaning towards Great Gatsby.
Baz Luhrmann's Gatsby's rule.
And you bought me a green light.
Yes, I did. So, yeah, we'll go with Gatsby.
Yeah, Great Gatsby's the movie that made me.
It sounds like you took away all the wrong lessons. Do you want to do socials?
Yeah, I'll do socials. If you want to see me take all the wrong lessons in real time, you can find me at Midwest_magician. Apparently, I haven't been updating that like I thought I was, so you don't see that I was on a boat, but I was on a boat. If you want to follow the show on Instagram, you can find the Instagram at Two Men Movie Podcast. You can email us all of your X-Reader fanfics to twomenmoviepodcast@gmail.com. Still waiting for some hot core fiction.
Is there anyone from this movie you would want a fanfiction about?
Oh, oof.
Do you want to be Dev Patel when she's flipping you off?
I do want X-Reader.
You want that scene?
I do want that scene. Yeah, I'll accept only that scene. I will pay you $10 to write an X-Reader or an ex-Matthew by me getting jacked off by a possibly not real wife of a possibly not real man who might also be a grandfather.
And then being called not worthy.
You have to include that line where no money will be paid. You can find us on YouTube at Two Men and a Movie Podcast.
That's twomenmoviepodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, if you want to write the hand job scene with me, your favorite host, Matthew Olenchuk.
You can find me on Instagram, Threads, TikTok,
and
Lemonade.
Can you do like a written version of the close-up?
So you can find me on all of those things that I just said that I forget what they are now. At harrisonpool.com. HARRISON.
That took it out of you. I watched you deflate as a person.
HARRISONPOOLEDOTCOM. HarrisonPool.com.
You can't see him, Ethan, but he is. He does look like he's like death of a salesman, and it's like after he comes back and he didn't get the job.
You can find me on Letterboxd at HDPOOLE124. Do you have anything you want to plug, Ethan?
You can find me at Letterboxd at EKPool. That's at EKPOOLE.
Thank you so much to Tristan Hostetter for our theme music. Make sure you listen to his band, Natural Health, and Tonight with Vince. Tune in next week for Philip, who's bringing Minority Report.
Is next week?
Yes, because Mel is the last week.
I thought she's next week.
No, Mel is the 14th. Fuck. Anyway,
do we think this is a conversation that could happen after the end roll of the episode?
Yeah, 100%.
People love to see how the sausage is made.
No, I mean, sure. Anyway, I don't know how to end this. This episode's been a mess, but like, I'm very happy. Thank you for bearing with us, Ethan.
Yeah, anytime.
Just tune in next week for whatever the hell happens. So long and good night.
Hugs and kisses.
This is Matthew and Harrison's Two Men in a Movie. It's not what it sounds like.